It's easy to take for granted facts that, you know, kind of we assume that we've always known or that at least have always been known. For instance, that many birds head south for the winter and then they make their trek back to places like Wisconsin in the spring. But you know what? At one point in time, that discovery was earth-shattering. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you could join us today as we visit with Bob Montgomery. Bob's a professor of biology at Queen's University in Ontario, where he studies the evolution of plumage colors and sexual behavior in birds. And he is the co-author with Tim Burkhead and Joe Wimpenny of the book 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin. And he joins us today from Mouly, France. And it's great to have him with us. Bob, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
I'm delighted to be here, Larry. Good to talk to you.
Well, great to talk with you, and I'm really enjoying your book. Why the title 10,000 Birds?
Well, because there are 10,000 bird species. It seemed obvious to us once we started writing.
Well, I guess that makes sense.
Actually, to tell you the truth, I think we tried about 100 different titles, but that one just kind of stuck.
Well, I kind of like it. You know, in a way, it kind of tells a little bit the story of the book. So that's kind of a cool thing. And I should mention to our listeners that I want them to join in, too. Are you a birder as you listen in? How much do you know about the history of ornithology? Tell us about your birding experience. Is there an ornithologist or other biologist who has really influenced you? Join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post a question, and maybe if you got a great bird photo, we'd love to see that, too, on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show for that, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. The subtitle of your book is Ornithology Since Darwin, but I'm going to ask you to go back before. Let's talk about life before that. Even the ancients were fascinated by birds, weren't they?
Oh, definitely. And Aristotle's writing even is full of good bird lore. He was quite a good observer, you know, for somebody who lived 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. And as you fast forward to more modern times and the scientific revolution of, say, the 17th century, what were the prevailing ideas of birds and biology at that time?
Good question. First of all, they didn't really have the concept of evolution, certainly not natural selection the way we understand it now. And so there was no really good framework for the study of birds. It was all, you know, observe this, observe that, and write it down.
And there were some groundbreaking developments in the 17th century, including looking at the different adaptations by different species of birds. And that was, why was that such a big breakthrough?
I think, you know, all of the Renaissance was like that in just about every science. You know, people started to actually observe things rather than take it for granted that what Aristotle said was true, and, you know, people started doing experiments. And then, of course, the opening up of the new world and exploring new lands just brought a whole array of new ideas and species to scientists.
Yeah. And, you know, you think about it, the science and biology, it was really intertwined with religious beliefs. Did that help or hinder the advancement of ornithology?
You know, in a strange sort of way, it actually probably helped that one of the earliest great ornithologists was John Ray, who lived in the late 17th century. And he wrote ornithology with Francis Willoughby that was really the foundation of all of ornithology. And he also was famous for his religious beliefs. He wrote a book called The Wisdom of God and saw in birds and other living things God's hand in shaping the way they behaved and the way they lived.
Yeah, and then Darwin came along, and he was associated with evolution in general. Some of his most important findings were with finches, and maybe you can talk about his work a little bit.
Yeah, I can, actually. His most important discovery, really, was the mechanism for evolution. Lots of people believed in evolution before Darwin, so he was really the man who provided a logical and working mechanism that he called natural selection. And in fact, he didn't actually work on the finches. He collected them, but he didn't actually at the time realize their significance. He made specimens and brought them back to England, and it was his friend John Gould who realized that there were different species on different islands that were closely related.
Yeah, and of course his work, as you say, is out in the field, the Galapagos Islands, among other places.
Yep.
Observing animals in their habitat was not always considered the most effective or, I guess, meaningful way to study them, was it?
No, that's right. In fact, Darwin's best bird studies were probably his studies of pigeons that he raised, you know, in his house at his house in Down in England, where he could watch them closely and think about why they looked different. You know, different domestic species look so different, and he wondered why that might be.
Yeah, I was thinking back. One of the ornithologists said that the shotgun was the ornithologist's most important piece of field equipment.
That's true, actually, probably up until about the time you started your show in the 1960s.
you know, that's probably, that's not far from the truth.
No, it isn't. I worked at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto in the 1960s as a teenager, and that was how we did our work. You know, we'd go out and shoot birds and bring the specimens in and study them.
Talking today with Bob Montgomery, a professor of biology at Queen's University in Ontario, where he studies the evolution of plumage colors and sexual behavior in birds, and he's the author, or co-author, I should say, with Tim Burkhead and Joe Wimpenny of 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin, joins us by phone from France. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we visit with him. Maybe you're a birder. Maybe you... I'm wondering how much you know about the history of ornithology. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or again, post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We would love to hear from you. Tell us how your book evolved now, the 10,000 Birds. How did you get together with these two characters and put this together? Why?
Well, I'll tell you. It's a subject that has always interested me, but Tim Burkhead, who was the brains behind this operation, if I can put it that way, had written a book about the older history of ornithology, which he called The Wisdom of Birds, after John Ray's Wisdom of God, where he detailed what happened in the 17th century and 18th and so on. But when he got to the 20th century, he kind of stalled because there was so much to do. And so he published that book. I've been friends with Tim for about 20 years, and so I read lots of chapters for him and got quite interested in the topic. And then he said, you know, he really should do a book on the 20th century, and he asked me to join in. And so that's how it all started about 7 years ago.
And for our listeners, just to sort of set the stage so they understand, describe the book for them.
Okay, well, the book is really about the things that happened in ornithology and the study of birds since Darwin's day. We took as a point of departure the discovery of natural selection. And so it's ornithology in an evolutionary context. And we thought we'd tell the story by telling about the people who made the great discoveries from 1850 up until the present.
And I really enjoy especially the sort of remembrances or the discussions by several of those characters, mm-hmm. some of those people, and really... to me, it adds a lot of life to the book.
Well, Tim and I were fortunate that each of us worked with we did our own PhDs at institutions where two of the greats of 20th century ornithology work, so we knew them right for the last 50 years. And we both had 50 years of experience each in, you know, knowing ornithologists, so we were fortunate to be able to just tap our friends.
Yeah, and there's some great, and I mean, they're just sort of, you can just tell those are good, honest stories. We'll get to that. We'll get to a few of them. Ernst Mayr's, I liked his a lot. Is talking about Sewell, Wright, I believe.
Sewell Wright. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. Great story about him. Well, we'll get to that in a bit. We have callers online, by the way, who can join it. You can join in too if you'd like at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Just before we get to Jeff in Spring Grove, Illinois, though, how did ornithology move? You know, we talked a little bit about studying preserved specimens in a lab or museum to being out in the field observing birds in their natural habitats and interacting with them. And as a matter of fact, I mentioned Ernst Mayr, and he's probably one of the people that was really responsible for that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, many sciences move ahead by invention of new tools, and ornithology definitely benefited from binoculars, for one thing, and better field equipment. You know, that got people outside so they could see birds close up.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff in Spring Grove, Illinois, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
You're welcome. Good morning. I'm interested in knowing what kind of migrational changes have occurred in recent years. Being up here next to the state park, we're seeing most uncommon thing that we've seen in the last couple of years is American white pelicans that have migrated into the Fox Lake area by the hundreds. We've seen as many as a couple hundred now for the last couple of years and are here 6-8 weeks for the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 years. We're still looking at them today. What might
sure.
you put that on?
Shall I tackle that question, Larry?
Yeah, go ahead. Give that a shot.
So I don't know the pelican story exactly, but many species have started migrating farther north and earlier because of climate change. And we know that, for example, in Europe where I am right now, migration of many species has shifted 2 weeks earlier than it was just 2 decades ago.
So it's a couple of weeks earlier. And in the case of the pelicans, for here, which I'm you would have no reason to know this, but we really didn't see pelicans at all, as far as I can remember. I've been here a long time, up until just a few years ago. I mean, they just weren't here.
So possibly they're just moving farther north as the climate warms up. The other possibility is that their population is increasing and they're just expanding their range.
Yeah, that could be as well. Jeff, thanks for calling.
Thanks, sir.
Appreciate the call. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions or comments. I'm Larry Mueller, visiting today with Bob Montgomery, professor of biology at Queen's University in Ontario and co-author of the book 10,000 Birds. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look with Bob Montgomery at his book 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin, talking about the great history of this since Darwin's time. And if you're a birder or interested in birds or have studied ornithology or know someone who has, you may have questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And before we go back to the phones, Bob, you and your co-authors, you're entering a pretty crowded field of research and writing here, if what I see coming across my desk is any indication. How did you decide what to include and how to organize it?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things we wanted to do was to inform people about what an important thing the study of birds has been, how much it contributed to all these other fields. You know, often the pioneers in many fields were bird watchers and bird studiers, and so that was one of the motivations. And we just pulled ideas out of our heads for about a year, just trying to figure out what would make a good story.
Yeah. And one of your criteria is to emphasize the ways in which ornithology has advanced science as a whole, as you mentioned.
Absolutely.
What are some of the most significant areas where that's been the case?
Well certainly in evolutionary biology, study of birds has made huge and important contributions, both to natural selection and sexual selection. All of the work that the Grants have done for the last 40 years on the Galapagos Islands has been really important in nailing down some patterns of natural selection in the wild. There's been major contributions in physiology, migration, of course, you mentioned already, and in behavioral ecology, which is the discipline I'm in, the study of how natural selection influences behavior and foraging behavior and mating behavior. Birds have been at the forefront of those fields as well.
Tom in Cedarburg has a question for you. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I'm wondering, has the science of ornithology, made a serious effort into looking at the damage caused by windmills in Europe and the U.S. Near where I live is the Horicon Marsh, which I believe is the most visited nature area in the state of Wisconsin, and they allowed the windmills to be put up about 5-6 years ago, and they're within about 5 miles of this Horicon Marsh where we have all kinds of different kinds of birds come in. I'm wondering how much damage and death to the wild birds and I guess, the local birds also. And I'd like to mention, too, that about a week and a half ago, I saw my first, or heard my first phoebes come through, and now today I heard a towhee in my backyard.
Ah, so phoebes and towhees are back.
I guess so.
To Cedarburg. Oh, excellent. Bob, comment?
Yeah, certainly. There's a lot of work going on right now studying the effects of windmills, and there's no question that they have an effect on local bird populations. I just read a recent study from California looking at some of the windmill farms there, and particularly raptors get knocked down by the windmills. So it's a serious problem.
Yeah.
And needs work.
All right. Now, thank you, Tom. Gene in Duluth, Minnesota. Let's turn to you next. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for taking my call. A really interesting topic and speaker. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm an amateur mycologist, and one thing that's really shaking things up as far as taxonomy goes is some of the DNA, the molecular studies. And I'm guessing that ornithology is experiencing some of the same changes. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, birds were the first group other than humans to have DNA fingerprinting done in the mid-1980s, and that just totally revolutionized the way we study birds. So until that revolution, we thought most birds were monogamous, you know, males and females settled down with each other and led a happy, loving life, but because of that DNA fingerprinting work, we find that there's a lot of hanky-panky going on.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Bernd Heinrich's book, Nesting, that talks that was, a bit to that.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, thank you. I think you mentioned in the book that Sibley would have really liked to have had the DNA advantages that we have today.
Yeah, and he actually started it all, but he didn't live to see the latest advances.
Yeah, very, very cool. And Gene, thank you again for calling. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. I was thinking about the various people in your book and who you could cover in the book 10,000 Birds. You couldn't cover 10,000 people for sure. David Lack came out as a very significant ornithology. Maybe tell us about him a little bit.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy. He was originally a school teacher who was studying birds, and he did some really nice work during that period. And then this was in the 1930s, and he got tapped to be the director of the Edward Gray Institute at Oxford, and that really set his career off. And he just was a really good observer. He started working on Galapagos finches, worked on European robins, and did some revolutionary work in the 1960s comparing the clutch sizes of different species and reproductive behavior.
Yeah. So he was a lot of people, I think a lot of other researchers profited from his work.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he laid the foundation for much of modern ornithology, at least the field part of ornithology. And he would have been delighted probably and shocked to find that his studies of monogamy weren't actually correct.
Yeah, probably. Probably. Jim and Stoughton, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about the research with windmills and how many birds are being killed by the windmills.
Yeah.
I want to know if they are, I would like to know, do the researchers then figure how many birds have not been killed by the pollution from the coal that we didn't burn, the mercury that didn't get in the air, and the other heavy metals that didn't get in the air? I would think they would have a bigger impact on raptors because those things are passed up the food chain.
Yeah. Well, maybe you could talk, Bob, about how these studies are done typically.
Well, the windmill studies are just done by monitoring, you know, what's killed by the windmills, you know, simple as that. But your listener makes a really good point. We tend to focus on one aspect of the way birds are killed or, you know, environmental pollution and not on the other aspects. I think if you were to look for the biggest killer of birds in North America, it would probably be house cats, feral house cats.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he's also right in correct in pointing out that all of the pollution, the other kinds of pollution that come from the other sources could also have an impact.
certainly. There's always trade-offs, and that's a good point. I hadn't even thought of that before you mentioned it.
Yeah, that's very good. Thanks, Jim. Yeah. Appreciate the call. Dan and Viola, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Oh, hey. Hello. I'm over here in the west side of the state, and I saw a Canada goose the other day. I've been watching birds for, I've been a pretty avid birder for 60 years or more. And I saw a Canada goose the other day that, out of three, that was standing on a snowy bank, because we just got some snow, and one of them had orange legs. And I've never seen a Canada goose with orange legs. I wonder if maybe you guys have could enlighten me or seen a Canada goose with orange legs.
No, I certainly haven't. I wonder if
it might be a
hybrid with a white-fronted goose.
No, I know white-fronted geese, and this is three Canada geese.
No, I was saying a hybrid. I wonder if it was the product of a hybridization, you know.
I was wondering if that's possible, but all the millions of Canada geese I've seen in my life, I've never seen one with orange legs.
Yeah.
And hybridization would have come along in that respect maybe more often, but...
Yeah, possibly. It wasn't orange bands on its leg or something like that.
No, I could see his whole legs, but yeah. It was it's another one of those unsolved mysteries that keeps us intrigued, I guess.
Well, it's part of the variation that natural selection works on too.
Yeah. And so, and when we talk about hybrid, just for those who may not, you know, be familiar with what's going on here, it's it would be a coupling of sort of a snow goose and a Canada goose.
Probably a white-fronted goose.
A white-fronted goose.
Mm-hmm. And that geese and ducks are noted for their hybridization, so it's not unexpected.
So that's possible, huh?
Yeah, it happens a lot in ducks. We see, you know,
that's right.
I've spent a lot of time on a local lake here. I lived on a local lake for quite a few years, and observing the ducks, man, the the different colors of that look like they might have been mallards at one point, or really are mallards, but there's some sort of combination of colors out there that suggest a whole lot of different things going on.
Well, yeah, mallards will cross with, you know, farm ducks or roans or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it never ceases to amaze me. That's why I keep the binoculars handy.
Very good. And a hybrid will become a subspecies eventually, Bob, or could become?
No, not likely. There's been some examples of that when there's extensive hybridization, but a single hybrid is just, you know, kind of doomed.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Dan, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Rocky a chance in Neshkoro to join in. Let's see here. Rocky, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi. How's everything going today?
Just great. Appreciate your call.
Okay, I had a comment about the monogamy
yes.
thing. Back in Benjamin Franklin's day, he was very avid of trying to get the turkey as our national bird. Do you know why?
No, I don't.
Well, the reason why is he knew the eagle was not monogamous, and he believed the turkey to be.
Oh.
So, you know. Just a study of history along with your ornithology.
Unfortunately, he was wrong about turkeys, too, but that's another story.
Yeah, turkeys are not monogamous. As someone who has actually hunted turkeys, I have noted many times a tom turkey with 9 or 10 hen turkeys wandering around. Sometimes joined by another tom, often chased off. So that's for sure. Thanks, Rocky, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Bob Montgomery, our guest today, co-author of the book 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin. We were talking a minute ago about David Lack, and he wrote the book Darwin and His Finches, that was the title of the book, and it was, I think, 1947 when he wrote that. And you described that as utterly transformative. How so? Describe what you mean.
Well, what he did was to combine some detailed field observations with museum measurements and think seriously about what made the birds the way they are. So it was probably one of the first really detailed evolutionary studies that combined both field work and the museum work that had gone on before.
And he proposed that competition for food is really the driving force for evolutionary diversification of species. And why was that so exciting?
Well, I think the idea there was that just, he was able to identify what the force of selection might be, and just that other species might, different species might influence each other in the way they evolved. You know, it wasn't just the biotic environment, but the other closely related species.
Yeah. And then, who was it? Bowman, Robert Bowman, Canadian fellow, sought to challenge Lack's work. And
that's right.
Why was that?
Well, it's a very good question. We tried to figure that out. Probably because his own supervisor didn't like the idea of competition. There's been a long ongoing debate for the last 40 years about how important competition is, and it's really never been thoroughly resolved.
So, so there was sort of, all right, I don't like that, so we're going to go.
Yeah, well, it's a bit like conservatives and liberals and, you know, Democrats and Republicans. Scientists, too, have different points of view, and it's pretty hard to shake their points of view.
Yeah, and so the result of that, what was the result of that?
Well, he did another detailed study and worked on the finches for about 10 years, going to Galapagos and raising them in captivity and so on. And I think he really just supported what Lack had shown in the end, that they really found pretty much the same thing but interpreted it slightly differently.
So he was sort of refined the, rather than refute it, he refined the
that's
the thinking.
Right, yeah.
Well, let's talk about paleontologist John Ostrom.
Mm-hmm.
He had a discovery in 1964, I believe.
That's right.
What did he find?
Well, he found a dinosaur that made him wonder whether birds might be dinosaurs. It was a very bird-like dinosaur. And that got him thinking, well, maybe birds really are dinosaurs, and we should explore that a little more.
Yeah, and of course, what was the significance of that?
Well, it was, again, kind of revolutionary. If he was right, and he was, then the dinosaurs are really still with us. They're just here in the form of birds.
Oh, yeah, and I think that really turned science on its head a little bit.
Yeah, it did. And like many interesting periods in the history of science, it was very controversial for a long time. Still, there are still few people who don't think birds aren't dinosaurs, but overwhelmingly the evidence suggests they are. And so the dinosaurs really didn't go extinct. They just evolved into something else.
And I think that not only have they not gone extinct, but they may have been warm-blooded.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. So, and I think all of that interest in birds as dinosaurs has given us some great insights into the dinosaurs themselves and that period of time, just exactly what their behavior might have been like and what they might have looked like and so on.
And was there? Could you give us an example?
Well, by looking at some of the little particles called melanosomes in the fossils, we can now have a pretty good picture of what those ancient birds and ancient dinosaurs actually look like. So we know about some of the colors and some of the patterns, and we also know that many of the dinosaurs, not the bird-like dinosaurs, but other dinosaurs, were covered with fuzz, so they were kind of hairy, with a little proto-feather on them.
Talking today with our guest, Bob Montgomery, about his book, 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin, inviting you to join in with your own bird questions. At 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We would certainly love to hear from you. Please do join in. One of the more fascinating chapters in 10,000 Birds is the chapter 3, I think, Birds on the Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's daunting enough to think about figuring out how different species of birds relate to one another, let alone to all the other families of animals.
That's right, yeah.
How was that research done?
Well, most recently by DNA sequencing, and that's proven revolutionary. We finally got some of the answers that people have been looking for more than 100 years, you know, figuring out exactly what species are related to what and what groups are related to what. That's a work that Sibley really revolutionized initially in the 1980s.
And Ernst Mayr was certainly played a big role.
Yeah, he did. He would be in what we would call the older school, you know, prior to the discovery even of DNA and certainly of using it to do phylogenetics. You know, he was in the school where you'd looked at species and measured them and try to figure out what was related to what. But many of the patterns that people discovered in those days was overturned when we got to DNA.
Yeah. How did he get from the lab to the field? I mean, what...
Mayr, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he was mostly a museum man. He did work in the field in New Guinea when he was in his 20s, but after that he made very few field trips, mostly working in museums, measuring specimens, and thinking about patterns.
You know, it's funny. I had it in my head that he was someone who really saw the value of getting out in the field and studying, but maybe I'm...
I think he did see that value. He just didn't practice what he preached. He encouraged lots of other great people to get out in the field, and he, you know, he loved being outdoors. But he certainly didn't, except for maybe one field trip, really didn't do any field research.
That's very interesting, Don in Maryland, Wisconsin. It is your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Well, thank you, Larry. I just have a story and a kind of a question. A while back, I was just sitting in my kitchen and. I'm looking out the French doors, and a chickadee, a very young chickadee, flew into the window, crashed, and fell down on the porch, laying there, legs up in the air. I went out, and I thought he was dead. You know, I picked him up and started to, and I, as soon as I picked him up, he started moving around a little bit, so I knew he was still alive. And I started massaging him, stroking him in my hand, the palm of my hand, and pretty soon he kind of hopped onto my finger, my index finger. And I kept stroking him. The dog came out and was offering his ablutions. And all of a sudden he flew off up to the roof, to, the gutter, and stayed there. I was just watching, and suddenly he flew back and landed on the brim of my hat, baseball cap, and then hopped down onto my hand again, and kind of looking out, you know, looking at me, and all of a sudden just took off for the woods, and he was gone. And I just wondered, and my question would be, would you explain this? It was a very young bird, and I wondered if it might be due to. Imprinting possibly or something like that.
That's a great story.
Probably not imprinting that quickly, but the only thing I can say is people often do kind of crazy things when they're bumped on the head as well.
Well, after being revived, I thought maybe he might, might be offering a thank you or something.
Well, animals appear to do that sometimes, and that's quite possible. Really? We don't understand a lot about the way their brains work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You hear the story bird brain, or somebody calling somebody bird brain when they're sort of not a nice way of calling somebody something. What about that? When I call somebody, if I called somebody bird brain, would that be not a good way to sort of describe a bird's brain?
No, they're very smart, as your caller suggested, and we know that, you know, birds like crows and jays have incredible memories, and so it's interesting. I wonder where that phrase came from. We use it all the time too, but it doesn't really work.
It doesn't really work, and this whole business about imprinting is interesting. Is there's something in the evolution, or what from your writings or research do we know about imprinting?
Well, we know that when many animals, or young birds in particular, they fix on their parents, whatever happens to be parenting them, and often will choose mates that are similar to their parents. There's probably very good reasons for that imprinting.
So they actually choose mates that are very similar then.
Similar to what their parents look like, you know, there's some advantages of mating with not really close relatives, but, you know, members of your social group.
Yeah. All right. And Don, thank you for calling, by the way.
Well, thank you very much, Larry.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Talking today with Bob Montgomery, professor of biology at Queen's University in Ontario, and talking about his book, he co-authored, 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin. Again, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Great to have with us today Bob Montgomery, a professor of biology at Queen's University in Ontario and author of 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin. Again, you can join in with your question. You have a question about birds? I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. I want to go back to Ertzmeyer for a minute because I got such a kick out of his story about how Sewell Wright, influenced, became a really good. The fact that he was a terrible lecturer helped him out so much.
That's right. Yeah, it was a talk he was giving at Ohio State University, and I think he really benefited from having a poor speaker before him. It wasn't a hard act to follow.
Yeah, and Sewell, I think, had talked to a chalkboard essentially the whole time, and occasionally would turn around, and then Ertzmeyer came out, and he was, you know, had nice slides and had practiced and stayed right on the microphone, and that resulted in him being perceived as a very good person and someone who could contribute book chapters and so forth.
That's right. Because of that talk, I think a man named Dunn came up to him and asked if he'd be willing to give some Jessup lectures at Columbia University, which were justly famous. And from that, again, by a stroke of luck, Meyer got to write his one of his most famous books as a result of those lectures. So
it's interesting, you know, and so there's some pretty colorful people that are associated with birding. And I'm trying to remember, you know, there's so many here. I'm trying to remember one fellow who actually, they think he even might have murdered his wife.
Oh, yeah, that was Richard Meinertzhagen. And there's been a great book written about him called The Meinertzhagen Mystery by Brian Garfield. Just worth people having a look if they're interested. And he was a colossal fraud and probably, as you said, probably a murderer.
and just mention what he was about.
And a character. Well, he lived in the early part of the 20th century, and he was from an aristocratic family. And one of the things he was discovered to have done later was to have visited the British Museum of Natural History and stolen specimens, taken them home, changed the labels, brought them back to the museum, and then made discoveries based on his relabeled specimens.
Oh my goodness. Well,
shockingly enough, he was banned from the museum for a while, but then they let him back in again, and he did it all over again.
Oh, man. I've spent a little time in that museum. Mm-hmm. I once had the head of the museum gave a private tour of the museum, and mm-hmm. I'm sure I've mentioned this on the air before, but we were in the insect collections area, and he said, and you know, all the collectors have signed their work, and you see the insects, and he pulled out a tray and said, look, for here, take a look at this one. And I'm looking at a tray and I'm holding a tray, and it was some insects that Charles Darwin had collected.
Fabulous.
that's the kind of thing you don't soon forget.
No, that's right.
Now you never forget it. Mark in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, that was fast. I didn't even dial in 30 seconds ago. I wanted to clarify something about John Ray for the audience, especially since Mr. Montgomery went out of his way to cite Ray for the importance of his early work as a naturalist. If I heard correctly, Mr. Montgomery made two stabs at identifying ray's lifespan. The 1700s and the late 17th century, which would obviously be the late 1600s. It should be noted that Ray was born in 1627 and started teaching at Cambridge in 1651, and that his whole multifaceted career at Cambridge was already over by 1662, whereupon he started publishing academic works for the rest of his life. He did live until 1705. And one could have thought from the guest's remarks that that this person was born in the late 1600s.
That's right. I was actually referring to his ornithological work, which is in 1676. I didn't mean to imply he was born in the late 1600s.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Mark, for calling. And I want to give Julie emailed us and had a question here that I think is an interesting one for you. She says, my 14-year-old is a budding ornithologist. She has The Wisdom of Birds by Tim Burkhead, and I don't know if you're familiar with that book, but she wonders if you could recap any other good reads besides your book, which she would be excited about for sure. For her, as far as a good foundational reading?
That's a good question. There are, of course, thousands of bird books out there. I find that the books of sort of bird adventures are to me most interesting, and certainly when I was a teenager. You mentioned Richard Meinertzhagen, and actually his book called Pirates and Predators really inspired me when I was a teenager, even though he may have actually made it all up. but there are lots of books out there, you know, where people have written about. John Alcock, for example, has written some great books about his adventures in Arizona, and Bernd Heinrich, who you mentioned earlier, has some excellent books about his bird work in Vermont.
So those are good ones. And she also wonders, as a parent, what types of activities or resources are most helpful to grow this passion?
I think just getting out in the wild, not being too cautious about getting your feet wet. Getting out in the marshes and the woodlands and just seeing what's out there.
So how I just going with her,
yeah,
or taking her out.
Taking her out I don't know in your area, but where I grew up in Toronto, there was a group called the Toronto Junior Field Naturalists, and that was a great inspiration for me. Like-minded people of my age all getting together with a leader and learning about birds and getting out in the wild.
Yeah, and actually. Also for Julie, we'll be talking in not too long now, in a few minutes actually, about the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, and that's coming up here in Wisconsin quite soon, and that's something that she might want to get involved. The Wisconsin Society for Ornithology is sort of involved, and we have Andy Polias on, who is the coordinator of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, and he's also a biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And I think there's some pretty interesting goals for something like this. And I don't know if you have birdathons in your part of the world or not, Bob.
Yeah, absolutely. That's you're right. It's a great way to get out there and meet like-minded people. Right now, there's a raptor-thon going on in Ontario, and that's to look at hawks and owls. And the birdathons are great. And I should also mention eBird from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, where just anybody can upload their observations, and you can follow what's going on in the birding world.
Yeah, and that Cornell Lab is really something, isn't it?
Absolutely fabulous.
Yeah. Fabulous. Well, you study the evolution of plumage colors and sexual behaviors in birds. Would you tell us how that area of research has developed over the years?
Well, I mentioned earlier about how tools influenced science, and they certainly did in this area. I've always been interested in bird colors, but it wasn't until about the late 1980s, early 1990s, that we actually got an instrument where we could measure colors in the field, and that revolutionized the study of bird coloration.
And how does it, for you, how do you, tell us about your own research and what you do.
Well, I can tell you about the most recent work I've done with PhD student Roz Dakin. And for that study, we went to the L.A. Arboretum and worked on the the peacock population there, looking at how they display their colors. And it was great fun.
Oh, and I want to make sure that, to talk about your last chapter, which is Tomorrow's Birds.
Mm.
You raised the alarm that tomorrow's birds are under some serious threat. Talk about that.
We did. Well, you know, that's another area where studies of birds have made huge strides, you know, right from Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which was all about, you know, the loss of birdsong in the woods, to the present day. You know, birds tend to be like the canary in the coal mine. It's an apt kind of metaphor. Birds are everywhere, canaries in coal mines, you know, in the environment. So because they're so well studied, we tend to notice things that are happening with birds often before other animals.
And you have a cool picture of Rachel Carson in your book, by the way.
Yeah, I love that photo.
I love that photo, too, because it's, you know, I've never, the photos I've ever seen of her were so much kind of more formal or, you know, I don't know what you might call it, academic.
Yeah.
And here she is in a swimsuit.
Yeah, standing up to her knees in water.
Yeah, that's such a great picture. I really like that. Well, what are the, talk a little bit more about the, what are the most exciting areas of ornithological research right now? What's left to learn?
Well, one of the good things about science, or what makes science so interesting for us, is that you really end up asking more questions than you answer, and that, you know, expands your horizons. But the hot topics right now, obviously, are birds as dinosaurs. Some tremendous discoveries coming out of China almost every month about some new dinosaur-like bird or bird-like dinosaur.
Ah, and why China?
Probably because it hadn't been explored from that point of view before. You know, they're just very good fossil beds there. There's some areas of the world where there are excellent fossil beds, like where the Archaeopteryx is from in Germany. You know, excellent slate that preserves the fossils well.
Mm. Gary in Boscobel, I want to give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. I'd like to ask your guests a couple of questions. One of them is, it's always mystified me, is I have a particular attraction to the grouse of the grasslands of North America, and that includes prairie chickens and the sharp-tailed grouse. And I've witnessed and know of instances where prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse hybridize, and what's always fascinated me is how a female prairie chicken, who should be genetically programmed to respond to the color and the dance of the male prairie chicken, could actually respond to the color and the dance of the sharp-tailed grouse and then breed with that sharp-tailed grouse, which is completely out of sync with the behavior of the male prairie chicken. And then my second question would be is that I was always under the impression that when the great extinctions happened and the dinosaurs were eliminated from the earth, how are there dinosaurs left to be able to allow birds to evolve from that point if indeed most or all of the dinosaurs were involved in that extinction?
Well, those are two great questions. Let's start with the dinosaur one. And the short answer is we don't know exactly, but the birds were small, and it was the big species that mostly got wiped out. So that's one possibility, maybe because they could fly and get away from areas where there was devastation. As you probably know, we believe there was a meteor struck near present-day Mexico that caused a huge cloud around the world and led to the extinction of the dinosaurs and other species.
Mm.
And your first question was about prairie chickens. And again, that's a great question. One possibility is that some male birds of male species actually force copulations on females. And so it wouldn't necessarily be the female's choice if she got too near a male who was wanting to copulate.
And there are, I mean, I can remember reading articles about rape. It's just considered rape, yep, among mallards in particular.
That's right.
That it happens a lot, and I actually, I'm sure I've observed it on the local lake here in Madison, where that happened.
Partly because of the DNA work, we know that lots of species force copulations, and it's not uncommon in birds of all kinds.
Yeah. As you think about your book, and is there one person that really stands out for you as somebody you'd really like to if you don't know him or would like to have known?
I would say probably Ernst Mayr. You mentioned him already. He lived an entire century. He lived to be 101 years old, and saw so much that happened. I actually met him. He was the person who introduced me at the first scientific conference that I gave. Scared the hell out of me.
I can see why.
But he was great. He was very, very generous, and inspired me. And he had just retired at the age of 65, and he lived another 35 years.
Wow. Well, this has been fun. Bob, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And you've got a fascinating book here.
Well, thanks, Larry. I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you.
Bob Montgomery is a professor of biology at Queen's University in Ontario, where he studied the evolution and still studies the evolution of plumage colors and sexual behavior in birds, co-author with Tim Burkhead and Joe Wimpenny of 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin. And he joined us by phone today from the south of France, which made Judith very envious, for sure. Well, coming up, we're going to be taking a look at the Great Wisconsin Birdathon. Lots to talk about there. And I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.